You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 483.
It's in the darkest moments when the cracks allow the inner light to come out. Edward James Olmos.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com.
Well, guys, today we have a living legend on the show. We have writer, director, and actor Edward James Olmos. Now, if you're not familiar with Edward's work, he's been in projects like Blade Runner, the original Miami Vice. Got an Oscar nomination for Stand and Deliver. He directed and wrote American Me. He's currently in the FX show The Mayans and so many other classic Zoot Suit. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. He is a living legend. And in this episode, Eddie and I sit down and just go through his process as an actor, lessons he's learned, what he does, how he approaches character, and it is a masterclass on how a just master of the craft works. We go inside of Eddie's brain and really understand how he tackled iconic parts like his part in Blade Runner and in Miami Vice and so many other things. It is mandatory listening for any director hoping to work with an actor. It is fascinating and also extremely entertaining because he tells some amazing stories from the Blade Runner set, Miami Vice, and other iconic parts that he's played. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Edward James Olmos. I'd like to welcome the show, Edward James Olmos. How you doing, Eddie?
Very, very good, man. Just sitting here, thankful that we get to do this together.
Yeah,
a long time coming.
Yes, my friend. I appreciate you being on the show. You know, our paths have crossed many times, especially over at Lelief. I've had a few films play there, and we have a few mutual friends, and it's just been I've just been a fan of yours, man, since back in the day when I was coming up. But we'll get into all of that. But first, how did you get into the business? How did you get into this crazy business?
This one was a process that started when I was a little kid. I was born and raised in East LA, and I started to learn about discipline and determination, perseverance, and patience. And I started to learn that those values while playing the game of baseball as a little kid. And I learned how to do something that I love to do, and I learned how to do it every day, 7 days a week. And from 5 to about 14, I played ball every day, 7 days a week. I would either, you know, read about it, play catch or play, do it, or I would watch other people do it and talk about it. But I was always inside of the craft and the sport. And so when I was about 14, I switched. I had started to listen to rock and roll music about 1955, 56, when it started to hit on the radio. And it was really amazing that the stuff that I was listening to started to influence me. And I got into dancing and movement, and because it was a rock and roll period and everybody's dancing around going crazy. And so in 1960, I quit playing baseball, and I was really good. And people thought, well, they were grooming me to play professional ball. But I got into a rock and roll band, and I started singing rock and roll.
Wow.
And I started singing rock and roll like I played baseball, you know, seven days a week. You know, people say, well, you know, what do you mean 7 days? Like, yeah, I would touch the craft every single day in some form, and always on my mind, always doing it, always exploring. And what I learned was that the 10,000 hour concept.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You do something for 10,000 hours, and pretty soon you become as good as you could be after doing it for 10,000 hours. It doesn't mean you're better than anybody else. It just means that you're able to be the best that you can be inside of that craft. Anything that you spend time doing that long, that much, and consistently, and, you know. So, and when I got into music, I was 14. By the time I graduated from high school at 17, I went to East LA Community College, and I took an acting class. And so the acting would help me out at performance on the stage as I was singing. And I learned to encompass both theater and music and movement. And through 17 all the way up to 31, it was all combined. And then I hit with doing theater. I did Zoot Suit. That was a very amazing experience in theater as well as in film. And that really was the launching pad. Before that, I had done. I got into acting when I was in 1972, by way of a friend of mine told me that they were looking for some extras, and I went in for a job as an extra, and I got into the job. And then that job, the director needed someone to do a certain something for him in front of camera, and he chose me. And there was hundreds of guys there, and he chose me. And so I got up and I did it with him, and I performed, and that got me my SAG card. I got a Taft Hartley, and so I got into it. And from there, at 72 all the way to 78, I was still doing theater and playing rock and roll music. So I was performing all the time. Every day I was performing, whether it be on stage or be, and sometimes both. I would do both same time. And that's what happened when I hit Zoot Suit. I did it all. I sang, I danced, I did comedy, I did drama. You know, I was it was a live performance, and it was quite an experience. So you asked me, how did I get into it? It was a process. That process took me from a five-year-old of learning that I could discipline myself to do the things I love to do when I didn't feel like doing it. Mm-hmm. Into music, into theater, and finally into film and television and work in front of camera.
And what I love about your story, that the story you just told, is that so many people coming up, so many young filmmakers, young screenwriters, young actors, all think it's going to happen for them overnight. And it's like, oh, any moment, someone's going to discover my genius. and give me the opportunities that I obviously rightfully deserve. And what you're saying, like, you were literally doing 6 years, 7 years preparing for Zoot Suit, even though you didn't know that you were preparing for Zoot Suit. But all those skills were there waiting for you.
Luck comes into play, okay? And luck, it means the definition of luck for me, and for a lot of people, is when preparedness meets opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's lucky. And you have to have luck. You have to have luck. You cannot make it in anything. You cannot really move into an understanding of yourself without luck, meaning that you have to be prepared for the opportunity when the opportunity arises. I was prepared to do El Pachuco in Zoot Suit. I was prepared to do that role. It gave me something that I'm so grateful that it took me so long, because there was a lot of my friends who were, they were working at the age of 19, 20 years old, 21 years old. They were working in films and television and theater and doing everything. And I was working, and I was very happy to be performing live as a singer and in a rock and roll band. I worked at Gazzari's from 1964 through 1968, 7 days a week. And all through college, you know.
And and I didn't know that you sung and you were in the rock and roll scene, because now that makes your performance in Selena so much more riveting, because you actually, I mean, there was something inside of you. You weren't just walking into a character. You might as well have been that character in many ways, had that experience.
Yeah, it was a good experience. That was a hard film, I will tell you that. That was the hardest film I made.
Any specific reason?
Yeah. The timing. Oh. Timing of that film was really, really difficult, because she had been killed about 13 months before we started filming.
Right, yeah.
That wasn't enough time. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to film. The father didn't want to film. The family didn't want to make the film right away. They wanted time to pass. But the world
wanted it.
Jumped on it. They jumped on it. Anybody could make a movie on her. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't need to, you know, all they had to do is just get an article, and they could do the film on the article, you know.
Right.
So it was really they were working on 5 documentaries, like around 6 or 7 books on her life. And they were making the people were starting ready to gear up to make a movie about them. And this was only like 11, 12 months after it started, you know.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And Abraham, her father, he got in touch with myself. He got in touch with Gregory Nava and with Moctezuma Esparza. Mm-hmm. And all of us got together and we helped produce it. And you know, Greg directed and wrote it with Barbara Martinez. And they did a wonderful job.
That was wonderful. And, yeah.
But it was so hard, man, because every time we do a scene, get a load of this. Every time we did a scene, the only person who came to watch every single scene that was shot, every single moment of the film, was the father,
Abraham.
And the kids, none of her brothers, sisters, Chris, none of the band, nobody got involved, unless they were in the movie. There was a couple of kids that were in the band that played with us in the movie. But every time we do a scene, like anyone, pick any scene you remember, and imagine when they holler cut, whether it be, you know, playing the drums and falling over, or driving the bus, or Bustikaka. You know, all the great scenes that we're doing on their life, the humor, the fun. After, when they would holler cut, I'd turn and I'd see her father, Abraham, about 10, 15, 20 feet away with his back towards us in heaving sobs. Heaving sobs.
Oh, my God.
Just completely just destroyed as he's watching the life story of his daughter who had just been killed. And it was really very, very ugly. It was
terribly
difficult to make this film. And it was the hardest film I ever made because of the emotional yin yang, because you'd be happy, you'd be like having a good time doing all the stuff in the 60s when they were little kids.
Yeah.
And teaching them to play bass. No, I don't want to play bass. I know you don't, but play bass. You'll play drums. You play drums. Drums, girls don't play, you know, all that stuff, you know. and all the stuff about, you know, it's tough to be a Mexican American. You got to be more Mexican than Mexican, more American than American. You got to be able to, you know, all that stuff, all those scenes after scenes of wonderful moments. And the one scene that we were able to do that, I mean, the only scene that really just like, he only allowed us to shoot it one time, was the scene in the hospital. He didn't want it. He didn't want it in the movie. And Greg said, we got to put it in. I mean, that pain has to be understood. Mm-hmm. Abraham, there's two ways around it. I'm sorry. But, you know, this movie is about that. That's what this movie's about. It's about you and your family and everything you guys had to go through and felt at that moment in time, along with the rest of the world. That movie holds up pretty well. And I think it's Jennifer's performance. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Lopez.
And I remember you on some interview saying, when I saw her get up on stage, I said, oh, she's got it. Oh, she just got a taste of it. Watch out. She's going to explode, or something along those lines. You said, and you were not wrong. She's done. J-Lo's done quite good for herself. She's done all right. She's done all right.
Yeah, she's done very, very well. Very well.
Now,
she's really an artist, you know.
No, she's wonderful. She's absolutely wonderful. Now, one of my favorite performances of yours is one of your earlier ones, which is in that wonderful sci-fi film, Blade Runner. I can't even think of anybody else playing that part. It's like you were built for that part. How did you get involved with that? And what was that experience like on that set? Because I've seen every documentary on that film ever made. So I saw the craziness of, like, they took over, it was Warner Brothers, right? Warner Brothers backlot and built that entire thing. Like, what was that like? And how did you get involved with that project?
It came to me. They asked me to meet with Ridley Scott, and they told me, you know, a little bit about the character. And I went in and I met him. Remember, I had just finished doing, I'd been working on Broadway. I'd been doing a Zoot Suit for a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years. And I'd worked on Wolfen with,
I just had the writer on
Albert
the show.
Finney.
Yes, Albert yes, Finney. Albert Finney. I just had the writer on the show. Yes,
Albert, myself, and Gregory Hines, and
yes.
Tom
Newton,
Rachel, and a beautiful, beautiful experience. That movie, very intense, very, very advanced. And so when they asked me to go meet with Ridley, I understood the theme and I understood the situation, and it was a very minor role. It was,
but it has an impact. But it has an impact, that role.
Well, it has an impact for what. See, one of the great things about working with people who are secure, people who are secure allow growth around them, and that's really. I've been very fortunate to be working. I've worked with people who are very secure. They allow expression. They allow ideas. I had by 1978, when I did Zoot Suit, I gained artistic control of my characters. And that was one of the things that I asked for whenever I worked. I don't mind, you know, collaborating, but let me develop the character. You know, and hopefully it's what you had in mind. And most of the time, and I'd say about 98% to 99% of the time, they had none of this in mind. They just ended up overwhelmed by what they were experiencing at the same time that we were filming it, because they didn't know what I was going to do. I'll never forget, I walked into Ridley the very first time and I said, I'd love to work with you on this. This is a very important piece of work. And I said, this is the future. You're talking about 2019. We're speaking together in 1980.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and I said, this is going to be 2019. So 40 years from today. And it's going to be a little different. It's going to be, you know, diversity, characters, and culture will be beaming off of California and Los Angeles. And you know, of course, the environment will have gotten to a point of it being difficult, and everything came true. Everything's true. I mean, all the cultural dynamics of the city, weather, you know, environmental change and warming that's happening. Yes, everything's changed, and we knew it then in 1980 while we're discussing the film. And so I asked him if I could speak languages. I said, I'd like to speak languages if I could. And he said, what do you mean? I said, and he said, what's that? I said, I don't know. It's just tones. Those were just tones. But you know, just different. It could be anything. It could be Hungarian with French and, you know, whatever. But that's what it would sound like. And he said, interesting. And so I gave him a character breakdown off the top of my head, improvised breakdown of where my great-great-great-grandfather came from and where my great-great-great-grandmother came from when they got together. And how they got together in respects, and then they had children, and those children were born in here and here, and then they got married to here and here. And by the time they got to me, there were 10 different cultural dynamics that were working in direct descendants of different cultures. And so he thought it was, says, I like it. So he let me go. But then I took off with the script that they had written, and I went to Berlitz, and I started to get the different languages that I would use inside of the piece. And I was saying the words that they had written, but I was saying them in different languages. And so when I got to work, nobody knew what I was saying.
Of course.
It was city speak. I had invented city speak.
That's amazing. Okay?
And then with the advent of it being Asian influenced, of strong Asian influence, I started doing, I remember sitting in a scene and I did my first little origami, which was the chicken. Mm-hmm. And I made a very bad chicken and put it down and then squabbled, you know, like a chicken when it was put down. And I was in the scene, but I was way in the back. And so he was curious to what I was doing back there. And that's what it was all about. It was about being in the scene without being in the scene. Mm. And making sure that the realities that I was doing were realities that had something to do with what we were doing there. And It wasn't just me sitting there wasting my time or just drawing attention by the fact that I'm sitting there like a tree, and just, you know, not moving. Or, and if I started to move, I would draw attention to myself, which is even worse. So I had to be doing something. And so what I was doing was, and I found this little piece of paper. It was spearmint, the spearmint gum wrapping that's white on one side and aluminum on the other side. It was, the wrapper was inside of a ashtray standing right to my left of me as I looked down because I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I looked down, I picked it up. And so while the scene's happening, I'm working on this piece of paper. And this little piece of paper ended up being looking like a chicken. And I kept on the whole time the scene was going on with between Decker and the captain in the police station when they do that thing, the thing there. When I finished, of course, when the scene finished, I put the thing down because he didn't want to go do the, he didn't want to be cut. He was retired. When he came in, I was retired, and now I'm still retired. So he was like a chicken, you know? And so... And so I put the thing down and I did the squawk at the end when he said cut. I put it down and squawked. And he came over and he looked at what I was doing. He looked at me and he says, hey, bring me a camera. And they got a guy to make the chicken. Somebody made the real
origami chicken.
Chicken was good, but it wasn't as good as the one that this guy made. And one of the prop guys. And so he made the prop thing and I put it down and that was it. Then we went to another scene where we went to Leon's apartment. And in Leon's apartment, he's walking around doing stuff. Now, I had nothing to do while he was doing out exploring and, you know, looking for things and what, you know, who was he was looking for the replicants. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so he's doing all of his research and stuff. And it's all about him. So I was back to, but I didn't want to cause any, you know, what I wasn't looking for the replicants. Okay. Mm-hmm. I was there to drive. I was like a driver for him. Okay. But right. At the same time, you find out this happened, like, as the story evolved, my character then grew with a certain kind of dynamic for the story. And so while I was there waiting for him to do his thing, I stood over on the side and I found a matchstick. And so I worked on the matchstick and I gave him a little hard on. So the little matchstick I put mm-hmm. so he could stand up, a little guy with a hard on. So that was, I was doing him, I was doing Decker, mm-hmm. you know, coming to see Leon.
It's amazing.
So,
yeah.
So I put it down and of course they filmed it. They filmed it. So now I had two of them, two origami pieces in the script. Little did I know until later on when I went to see the rough cut screening of it, that the last origami was the unicorn. I didn't make the unicorn. I didn't even think about it. Okay. I had nothing to do with that unicorn. But Ridley had taken that whole understanding of my character and what I was doing there and how he worked it through and how I worked out what I was doing, that he ended up making it so that the unicorn was found in the elevator right before he steps in the elevator on the ground. He looks at it and it's his past. It's his a dream, a reoccurring dream that he has. So at that moment in time, and I thought it was genius on Ridley's part, he made Decker a replicant. Mm-hmm. but he didn't know it. So
that's amazing.
It was amazing. And so he did it with such purity of understanding how, and that's what I mean, he never confirmed
for years he didn't confirm it.
He never confirmed it, but till finally I guess around maybe 10 years ago, maybe 30 years after, mm-hmm. he finally did confirm it.
Yeah.
And Decker was a replicant.
And the thing that's brilliant about that story is, and you said something so, so important for young filmmakers to hear, is when you work with someone who's confident, who's comfortable, secure in their own skin, as a director, you allow the other artist that you're working with to bring you all this wonderful stuff that you can do. Because if you try to control it, that's insecurity. When you have someone who's so insecure that they have to control everything, nobody can work properly in that. Not an artistic standpoint, at least.
No. It's a communicated art form in which, mm-hmm. you know, everybody that's touching it is artistically involved.
Yeah.
Everyone. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're, you know, makeup, you know, you can be props, you can be location, you can be, you know, anything, wardrobe. All of those divisions and you know, they all have an artistic impact on, and of course the director can, you know, sit there and pick every single piece of material that's put on their clothes. He can, every single mm-hmm. artistic, you know, production value could be all his, and camera, of course, is all his, and he can be working with the best camera people in the world. But he feels that he knows his vision, so we'll put the camera here, and won't be open to the suggestion, you know, because I'm, you know, Ridley's really good. He's brilliant.
He's done okay for himself.
Brilliant filmmaker, and the kids that I've been able to work with through the years,
yeah,
extremely good, and so I've been very fortunate that they have all been secure enough to work with me, to allow me to create. And so I've created, nobody wrote, Lieutenant Castillo of Miami Vice. Nobody wrote Gaff. Right. Nobody wrote El Pachuco. They wrote it in respect to the words that come out of my mouth. But as far as the physical and the dimension and the psychological and the emotional and, you know, everything, especially the physical, those are creations by the artist, the actor, unless you're working with someone like Alfred Hitchcock, who tells you to take 10 steps, turn around, say the line. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Hi. That's it. And that, and so there's very little, you can still use the how you walk, you know, and how you scratch your face or how you stand, whether you have your hands in pockets or don't have them in pockets. And it's choices that the actor makes to create a reality for the moment. But, you know, we'll say that you're right. Working with secure people is a really wonderful virtue.
Now, when you were working on Miami Vice, I mean, I grew up with Miami Vice, and when you showed up, you brought such a authority. And I think it's fair to say that many of your characters, you as a general human being, just there's an authority to you automatically for whatever. And there's people like that. They just walk in the room. They're like, there's respect there. You don't have to say a word. And I think with Castillo, he was one of those characters that you just looked at you at that time in your life and you're like, you do not want to mess with this guy. I remember there was I don't even want to tell you how old I was, but I remember watching there was a character arc for you where you went off, like, because you were always the quiet, secure, you know, you were the rock. You were the one that was silent, said very few words, and just everyone just respected you. But I remember there was a character arc in Miami Vice where you were on a revenge kick, or there was something that you were doing. You were off character, and you were like, "Oh my God, Castillo's lost his mind! Oh my God!" And that's always the most fun when the quiet character who's super powerful is like, "Oh no, we're going to see what he's really about now." And you went off for like an episode or two. I remember I was just so enthralled. It still affected me to this day. I remember that. I'm like, "Oh my God, Castillo's losing his mind. This is going to be amazing. Let's watch this." And but how did you, I mean, I know there was another actor. I know you and I spoke about this a little bit when we spoke earlier years ago, but there was another actor. And then you came in to play this part. And then you kind of just went on for that because you weren't there originally.
No, Gregory Sierra.
Right. Fantastic actor.
He passed away just recently. Well, this last year. When Michael Mann asked me to join up with him, he called me on a Wednesday, and the film started. I needed to be there by Thursday morning at 7 o'clock to be in character and jump in and start playing this character. And I said, when he called me the first time, I said, I can't do that. You know, I wish I could, but I can't. And he was very disappointed, and he had offered me a really more money than my father had made in his entire lifetime of work. It's the first offer. So he knew what he was doing, and he knew that what he wanted. And he came straight to me and said, one-on-one call, telephone calls just between me and him. And I said, I wish I could, man, you know, because I told him, I said, there's a couple of things that why I can't, I would love, let me tell you something. I would love nothing more than to be on the show. Okay. But I can't sign an exclusive contract with NBC. I can't. I wish I could, but I really can't. And, you know, I was pretty young. So I guess it was about 36, 37 at the time. Right. And 1984. And I said, I can't sign an exclusive contract, and I have creative control of my characters, Michael, you know, and by this time since 78, I gained that understanding in my life. I didn't want to work on pieces unless I had creative control, and that stopped me from being able to do a lot of work because people found that out, and he wants creative control, so they wouldn't even call me. So I'm sure I lost a lot of work, but the people who did call me and allow me to work with them, you know, and Selena and you know, Mi Familia and American Media and Stand and Deliver and Miami Vice and, you know, the list goes on. They did get something for giving me that opportunity. And so Michael said, didn't say anything. I said, that's the reason I can't. And thank you very much for calling. I hung up the phone. 10 minutes later, he called back and doubled the money.
Holy Jesus.
And I said, oh, Jesus Christ. I couldn't even believe it. I couldn't quite grasp what he was saying because I was going to do 20 shows and those 20 shows, whether I worked in them or not, I would get paid. And I said, you know, that's it was amazing, amazing. And I said, listen, Mikey, what are you going to be doing in this time next year? And he says, well, you know, I'm going to be doing Miami Vice. I said, yeah, but what else are you going to do? He goes, well, I'll be doing Manhunter because I've been prepping that for quite a while now. And so I'm pretty sure I'll be able to get it started next year. I said, great. So you're going to be doing Manhunter while you're still doing Miami Vice and getting paid for it. You get to go off and make your movie. And you know, I'm working on, at that moment, I was working on The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez. I was walking around distributing it. And so I said, I'm distributing my movie and I won't be able to do that. And I won't be able to work on the films that I've been trying to develop and moving forward on. So I tell you, I'm sorry. I can't sign this exclusive contract, man. And I wish I could. Money's fantastic. And, you know, the opportunity's fantastic. And I said, you know, you know, my creative control is really, really important to me. And I know that you can't do that. I mean, you're a filmmaker and you're a really, you had done Thief.
Yeah.
That was a very big movie that he had done. And it was a huge success. And he had become who he is today. And, so we hung up and he called back about 10 minutes later and offered me more money. And I said, Mikey, I wish I could. I really do. This is really amazingly generous of you and wonderful, but I just can't. I cannot move forward without having artistic control and without signing a non-exclusive contract. And then he says, okay, and he hung up. And so 10 minutes later, he calls back. He says, well, you got it. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you got it. You just have to give me a 60-day notice when you want to leave, and you have to come back. I said, okay, that's 2 months. I said, that's fair. I mean, it takes me about 2 to 3 months to get inside of a character anyway. So I wouldn't want to jump out and do a character next week. You know, hey, I'm leaving tomorrow. I got to do a movie. You know, I wouldn't do that. Even for myself, I wouldn't do that. So I said, okay, 2 month advance notice, okay. And then he said, and you have artistic control of your character. And I said, oh, Mike, that's really, really amazing. And then I said, wow, that's really amazing. And I said, and I'll take the last offer.
So, yeah, the quadruple of the original. Yeah, that's the one I want. I'll take the last one. Thank you so much, sir. If you want to throw a couple more in there, I'm all about it. That's fine. Well, you definitely, I mean, when you came onto the show, it changed the show. It changed the energy of the show.
I don't even want to begin to tell you what happened. I mean, it was frightening because when I came on the show and I saw they sent me reels of the first mixes and rough edits of the first three episodes. Mm-hmm. I was going to be in the fourth.
Yeah.
And so I was watching them. It was on video. So I was at my house that night because I had to get on the airplane I had to be on the airplane at 10:30 at night, leaving LAX to be in Miami by 5:15 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's a 5-hour flight and get there about 5:15, almost 6 o'clock. And I had to go straight to the set and put on my wardrobe and go to work. And that's a tough one. It's mm-hmm. really tough. So I tried to grasp a hold of the world right away. And so I was watching the first few episodes and they were excellent. They're just really Thomas Carter directed the pilot and he did a brilliant job.
Mm-hmm.
And really it was what it was. And this is 1984. It was MTV cop show. It was high intensity music with high intensity drama and
action.
And
yeah.
Action. Okay. I mean, high intensity, but I noticed something. You know, I'd noticed the dismissal that they didn't know they were doing it. Well, I guess they did, but they thought it was very cool. And between Crockett and Tubbs, they would look at each other, like they would, the cameras would be on them, and you know, they'd be talking, say their lieutenant, the first one, or the chief of police, or the mayor, or the governor, or the head of the FBI, you know, all these people that they had to deal with, the CIA, the DEA, they were working with inside of all that world. So, but when the hierarchy came, they would look at the hierarchy, listen to them, honestly listen with, you know, compassion and understanding, and then look at each other and, you know, kind of like, and then come back together. And you knew on that look, that the audience knew on that look, that they had their own thing they would never
do. As they always do. They always what they do.
Yeah, they always do. Starsky and Hutch used to do it really well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had done that show also, so years and years ago in the 70s, early 70s. So what was funny was that I said, wow, this is going to be a tough one. Because, you know, I just felt that by them being able to do that kind of work, inevitably it would get a little predictable. Mm-hmm. They didn't know it. They didn't care. They were the stars of the show. As far as they were concerned, they were the show. Without them, there's no show. And I said, that's true. But they have to have something that's pulling and pushing them. So first episode, the first scene that I did was along the coastline of a inlet, a waterway inside of Miami. There's a lot of waterways, and we're along mm-hmm. this river kind of feeling. And it was an inlet. And there was a dead body of a girl, half in the water, half out of the water. And the scene was, I get there and I find out, not in the scene, but the people are finding out that's Crockett's
high
school sweetheart.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, it's his high school sweetheart. And so, you know, I'm standing there. I come in the scene, I'm standing away from them. Crockett's by the waterside, and Tubbs comes over and he gets close to me, and he's really close, and he says, you know, this is his. And then he tells me who that is. And then and I'm supposed to say something, you know, to him. But I turn when he finishes talking. I turn and I look at him and I say to him, don't ever come up into my face like this, lieutenant or detective. I said, detective. And like you right now going, you know, he did that on camera. It wasn't the line. And then Crockett, you know, he sees it and comes quickly, grabs him and pulls him away. And the director says, wow, that was really interesting. I like that. That was good. I said, yeah, I liked it too. That was good. So we got one take, we're done. All right. That was my introduction to Tubbs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the next scene that we did was inside the OCB, and it had to be in my office. And when I walked into my office, the very first moment I walked in, remember, I have creative control.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I could change those lines. I could, you know, turn around and do what I needed to do to build something that I was going to start to work on. Okay. With inside my character, they had their thing going and they would show and they were going to always run the plots and all the character driven stuff would be done through all of us. But they were the ones that were really, you seen the whole world through their eyes. So they were going to have to deal with me. Okay. So I gave my first left hook to Philip Michael Thomas, you know, Tubbs. And then I went on and went first scene I was going to do with Crockett was inside the OCB in my office. And I walked into my office and there was so much stuff in my office. I mean, there was pictures and there was mm-hmm. pipes, things of pipes, like if I had smoked pipes or maybe belonged to the old guy, I don't know, but there was junk everywhere. Oh, you know, they dressed the hell out of it. It looked like it had been used for years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I come in and I tell the set designer. I go, hey, can you do me a favor? He goes, yeah. He goes, please take everything out. I said, well, he goes, what? He says, take everything out. I don't want anything. Leave the desk, the telephone, leave the filing cabinets,
and
the chair and the filing cabinets, but take everything. Not a piece of paper, not nothing. Oh, and if you can, find me some aspirin in a little box case thing and put it right on the
table, it's amazing.
On the desk.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Okay, so they did that. They went in and did that. You know, they didn't ask any questions. They just, I said, please, you know, take everything out. And they did it. That no one ever said, no, I don't think we can do that. Or, you know, let me go ask. Nobody ever said nothing. They just did what I asked. And just like when I did the scene with, they were very respectful, and they knew and understood that what I was doing. Okay. And in respects of for things, just like when I asked for my wardrobe, the wardrobe lady called me up and she said, yeah, I just need your sizes. I said, great. I said, you know, I'm a 44 regular, and you know, I have a 16 inch neck, and I have 33 inch inseam, and my mm-hmm. sleeve length 16, and I'm giving her all the things, you know. And she goes, okay, I'll get. And I said, can do me a favor. And then she goes, yeah. She goes, can you please get me a black suit from Woolworths or Fedco or some really cheap place. And she goes, oh, well, then she tried to, you know, calmly, because this was her show. She was designing. I mean, she had gotten Versace and Armani.
They changed, Miami Vice changed the way men dressed for years after that show.
And in the world, not just here in the United States.
Everywhere.
So, because of Versace and all the big designers who gave them everything. It's just like the music.
Phil Collins.
Unprecedented.
Phil Collins. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it was unprecedented. They had Eagles. They had everybody.
Everybody.
They had Miles Davis music. They had James Brown music. They had Little Richard music. They had those characters on the scene and in the show throughout the duration.
That's how cool the show was for everybody listening.
Yeah, it was really, really cool to be in the show. But so I finished telling the wardrobe lady, please put in do me a favor and find me a wash and wear suit. Put it in the washing machine right as soon as you get it, and then hang it up to dry. Don't dry it in the dryer. Hang it up to dry so it dries kind of like long and has no shape. It's just this. And then she goes, well, Mr. Elmer said, we have a look, and you know, Michael Mann has a very strong saying. He goes, oh, I know. I said, I know. Go talk to Michael, and get me a thin tie, real, real thin tie, because it wasn't the time of the thin ties. Okay,
right.
1984 was not the thin tie look. Okay,
right.
Give me a thin tie, and you can put me in any shirt you want to put me in, any color you want to put me in, but make it a short sleeve, because I knew I was going to be in Miami.
Of course.
You know? That's too damn hot to be wearing long sleeve shirts and with a suit jacket on. Okay. As they put many times, they put Crockett and Tubbs in those kind of outfits. And it was just ridiculous. Humidity
brutal.
Was over.
Brutal.
So anyway, and I said, oh, and by the way, can you get me some, this was the best. She almost, I could almost feel her like throw up. I go, can you get me a pair of wrestling shoes? I want to wear wrestling shoes.
Okay, Pedro, come on. Like, did you have wrestling shoes on?
The high wrestling shoes with the high ankle.
Yeah.
Because I was going to be up standing up all day.
Oh, but then I never saw those shoes. I don't remember ever seeing
them. Oh, yeah, you saw them.
You know, I didn't.
If you look back and you go back, you'll see them. I even used the same style and the same shoe on Battlestar Galactica.
Because they're just comfortable. Because they're comfortable.
Comfortable. They're just comfortable shoes to wear. And so she, you know, she goes, I'll have to get back to you. I said, fine, great. Okay, just talk to Michael Mann. You know. He says, oh, believe me, I will. Okay, thank you. So she hung up. I didn't hear from her again.
Ever.
Okay?
Yeah.
Not again. But I get to work, and of course, there's my black suit, and there's my thin tie,
It's my wrestling boots.
a yellow, or I think it was either powder blue or a yellow short sleeve shirt, button down collar. You know, nothing like the guys were wearing.
It was, you stood out. Balls.
And I'm sure if had I not said anything, I would have probably been wearing an Armani suit. You know,
but that doesn't make sense for your character. But that doesn't make sense for
it. Doesn't.
No.
Of course it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. So anyway, I don't know what she would have put me in, but she wouldn't have put me in a black suit.
A Woolworth wash and wear suit. For all those listening, just Google Woolworth. Google that because I can't explain it.
it's you know. Anyway, so there I am in the scene with Crockett, first one. And I'm dressed, you know, and I'm ready to go. And I tell them to take everything out of the room. And the director goes, okay, are you ready? And he's like, yeah. And okay, Quine said, let's rehearse. And so, Quine, ready? And I said, just a minute. And I go over and I shut the door to my office. And then I sit down at my desk. And there's nothing on there. I don't have a piece of paper. I have nothing on it. I have a little box of, like I said, aspirin over in the corner. And I even think I took it off and I put it inside the drawer.
What business are you doing? There's no business for you to do.
I had no business yet.
Right.
This was the beginning of the show. I walk into the damn thing carrying a box of my own junk.
Right.
And I don't know anybody. And I'm saying, excuse me, can you tell me where my office is? And they all look at me and says, I says, I'm the lieutenant. And they go, oh, right over there. That's your office over there, sir. And so that's how I enter the movie.
The show, yeah.
Because they had just killed the other guy in the scene in the episode before. So I walk into this scene. Nobody knows who I am. Nobody knows anything about me.
Yeah.
So I said, well, that was better for me because then I could really do some real work and really throw some curveballs and stuff and people, you know, some sliders and people wouldn't know what the heck I was doing. And so, which was good for me and good for the show.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because it knocked everybody into a reality of saying, holy shit, who is this guy? So they weren't looking at me as the actor coming in. They were looking at me as the lieutenant coming in who they had no fucking idea who this guy was. And he's kind of weird, you know? And I was weird because off camera, I was just normal Ed walking around doing things. And I knew them both. I knew Phil Martin Collins, you know, I knew everybody, you know, and I had worked with them throughout the years getting to this point, you know, and so I close the door and I sit down and the director says, action. And so before he walks in, Don opens the door. And then steps back, and then he walks in, and he goes, and we do the scene, you know, da, 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 da. And I said, okay, and I said, okay, is everybody ready? Okay, yeah, good, okay, we're getting ready to shoot. Okay, everybody, take one, ready? Quiet on set. I go, just a minute, please, and I shut the door. And Don goes, no, Ed, leave the door open. I go, excuse me. He said, leave the door open. There's no doors here. We don't use doors because the whole OCB is just like the open area that you walk from one office to the other office. And, mm-hmm. and there's just, you're walking through it and you just, there's no doors. I said, but wait a minute, Don, excuse me. I'm sure you're right. But I just got on the show. I mean, literally, I'm walking into the scene and sit here. And I don't know you. I don't know anybody in here, and this is my office, and I'm sitting here with nothing, you know? I want the door shut. And he says, oh, yeah. And he just, you know, launches into, and I could see the camera department and
oh.
the everybody going, oh.
Oh, this is, okay, we're going to, they're puffing. Everyone's puffing up their shirts now. Let's get ready. The star and the new guy. Okay. Let's see.
So the door, he goes, oh, don't open up that can of worms with me, Eddie. I said, wait, Don, God, what are you talking about, Don? Don, think. What are you talking about? This is, think of the situation, Don. He goes, oh, Ed, And he walks off the set. He walks off the set. And now the director's going, what happened? And the first AD is going, everybody just take 10, everybody. And the director, the assistant director are like, and so they're quickly call it quickly. The first AD has to go over to see what the problem is with Don. So he doesn't come back. First AD doesn't come back. And pretty soon the lighting department and the engineers and sound department, they everybody's like gone from the building. I mean, I'm by myself sitting in the office.
Jesus Christ.
Hours.
No.
Hours.
They just shut down production?
He shut down production. I mean, we couldn't move. And then John Nicolella came and talked to him in his trailer. And after a long, long time period, I don't know how long it took, a long time, they finally, John Nicolella, who was producing it, came in and says, okay, we're ready to go. Let's go do it. And he goes, okay. And so I'm saying, is everything okay, John? He goes, yeah. Let's just do it. Okay. I go, yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready to do it.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
The director comes in. Everybody comes in.
Oh, no. Oh, no. The door, God. I'm waiting.
That's the door, man. And the director goes, okay, everybody ready, please? Quiet. All right. Ready. Now, everybody now is, I mean, beside themselves.
Right.
They're watching the situation happen as if they were like the audience watching it on the screen. Now they're watching it the same way because they don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
And sure enough, man, it happened. He comes to the door. He goes, action. Comes to the door, bangs on it, and swings it open, and it has Venetian blinds.
The 80s was that.
Hit the filing cabinet, and bam, they makes a big bashing sound. And he comes in, and he has a document, a folder, and he throws the folder on the desk right in front of me. Throws it at me. Boom. And he says, that's the information on the killing over by the riverside. And he says his lines, and then I don't even look at him. I'm in shock because now the character, I'm the lieutenant, and he comes in that way and throws the stuff at me right there. I just, what? My mind's going, what? And so he walks out, okay? I didn't look at him. I say my lines and he leaves. And are you there?
No, I lost you. I lost your video. Oh, there you are. You're back. You're back.
Am I back?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so Alex, and so he leaves and the director goes, cut. And I said, wow, that really worked well. That really worked well. I liked it. Hey, Don, did you like? He wouldn't talk to me. And literally, that's how we shot the first scene. From that day forward, Alex, for the first 20 episodes, I never looked at either one of those two guys in the eyes again.
I remember.
During any scene. All the scenes are like this. Imagine me doing my interview with you right now like this.
Oh, my God.
And you're asking me questions and me answering those questions, but I'm like this.
I remember that. I actually remember that because it's so odd. Even as a young kid, I'm like, that's just not the way humans speak.
Well, but not that so much. It just, it created a conflict.
Yes, absolutely.
It created a conflict.
Yeah.
So anytime I was in the scene, there was a conflict. And guess what? Now when those two guys looked at each other, it wasn't about dismissing the character that I was portraying. It was like looking at each other saying, this guy's off his ass, man. Man, this guy's a pain. And they were now looking at each other with a subtext that dealt more with a reality of a situation than just the, oh, yeah, this is a television show and we're here to knock and loose. Yeah.
Yeah, like Starsky and Hutch. Like, yeah, Starsky exactly.
It was Starsky and Hutch moments. Yeah. And I didn't mind them. I didn't mind that. They could dismiss anybody they wanted to. But if they weren't grounded,
right.
and had a different situation every time they came in to deal with me.
Right.
Then they, and pretty soon it became real evident because they started to do it too. It said, yeah, okay, well. And then one moment, I remember in one of the scenes, I looked at the wall. I stood up and I was looking at the walls that came in. And the director goes, excuse me, can you like turn a little bit so that I can see the side of your face? I said, why? I said, shoot the back of my head. Shoot the back of my head and my body. Shoot that. Let that be the... Don't you have to see my face? They're watching my face all the time. You don't need my face. And so,
oh my God.
I remember Don saying, so, Brian, it doesn't matter, man. He doesn't look at us anyway.
So he,
had caught on and said, it doesn't really matter, man. He doesn't look at us anyway.
and he kind of gave up that kind of thing.
It changed everybody's perspective, and I became the villain. I became the bad guy, and the audience, you know, the stuff that we'd get back, because at that time there was no texting, and there was no, you know, and
no social media. Yeah, there's none of that.
None of that shit. And so, but the word was out, you know, that, oh man, we don't really like that detective, man. We like the other guy better. This guy is just like, I don't know. I think he's a bad guy. He's just a bad guy. He's, you know, dressed in black. He never smiled. I never smiled in 4 years.
I know.
I never smiled. I never. But that character could not have been written. That was not, those choices were not, had they not had the confidence and given me the opportunity to create that character would never have materialized in television ever. And it changed a lot of perspectives on the unspoken word, the idea of shooting people always talking and while shooting people that were more just listening and seeing the impact of the things that were being said and done on people who weren't, you know, talking. They were just receiving and what it did to them and how it changed. That kind of depth in character study grew on that show. And well, people liked it.
I mean, that show is unlike any other show. And if you go back, you know, especially those first two or three seasons, it's like watching a masterful feature film every episode. It was just like, it was so well done. It was just so out of, there was just nothing like it on television. And I'll argue and say there's really nothing ever since of that kind of storytelling, that first, the use of music and action and character, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Now I have to ask you, cause we've gone off topic, we've gone down memory road here. I have to ask you about your new film, Chasing Wonders. Can you tell me about that project? What drew you to it? And it seems such a wonderful little film.
If you get to see it, I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but if you get a chance to see it, not too many people will, because it was made, it took about 6 years to make, 7 years to make. And there's a reason, because the actor, the young boy, had to grow. He had to get older. And so they used the same boy. And that was part of it. It was beautifully done. And it's a story, a simple story about a family and the unbelievable sacrifices that people do, you know, common everyday people. This takes place in Australia. A Spanish family immigrates to Australia. And when they were in Spain, they were grape growers for wines, really good wines. So this takes place on a grape farm, you know, for a winery. And so it's a story about a family, a simple family, and a little boy who has a grandfather. I played the grandpa, and it's a wonderful little story called, you know. To me, it's become a masterful little piece of work that done by most of it's in Spanish because they wanted that Spanish and English. The little boy speaks English. He speaks Spanish, but he spoke English, and you know, because he's from Australia, he was born there as a kid.
Sure.
And so you see him at the age of about 9 or 10 when he starts. And then when we come back to him, he's around 16, 17. And it starts off with him going back to his father's house in Spain. That's how the movie starts. And then you come backtrack into how he got to be who he is. And it's a simple, you know, wonderful little story that the sadness is that people won't be able to see it. It's not going to get exposure. They might be able to see it on streaming. They'll sure. probably stream it. Yeah.
Yeah, but it won't be well, right now, theaters is rough for everybody.
Yeah, I have one movie out right now with George Lopez. It was out in the theaters for about a week, maybe two. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful little story called Walking with Herb.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a wonderful. Yeah, it was a wonderful little story.
Didn't you do One in a Million with him?
Yes, I did.
Years ago. Yeah, I remember that. That was amazing. I have to ask
One in a Million. Paul Rodriguez.
Paul, God, Jesus, yeah, of course it was Paul. Paul, not George.
Paul
it was
and I
Paul.
Did One Million to One.
Million then, to One, that's
George,
it.
George and I did the George Lopez show. I did the very last show that he did on this show.
Yeah,
George. He brought me in for the last one. And then this one, which I just did, which he did an excellent job.
No, really George is remarkable. I've always been a huge fan of George.
Yeah, good.
And I have to ask you because I think people listening would kill me if I don't ask you about a little bit about Battlestar Galactica, because I mean it feels like just like Patrick Stewart was born to play that character in Star Trek, you were born to play your character in Battlestar Galactica, and it's just. Again, you had that control. Now that I know that you have creative control over characters, it's changed my entire perspective on your entire career because I could see now, like, okay, stand and deliver, got it, American Me, got it. Like, and you could start going back on all those performances, and you're like, okay, all those choices, many of those weren't on the page. You actually brought that. And to bring what you bring to the sci-fi world, and Battlestar Galactica was just a absolute phenomenon when it came out. People were going crazy for it. You know, go frack yourself and all that stuff. I remember I was at Comic-Con walking around and I had no idea about it. And I just see these bags like, go frack yourself. I'm like, what is fracking? What is going on? And then I started watching the show. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. How did you get involved with that? And what was your experience on that show? Because I mean, it was amazing.
The experience was remarkable because the writing was so pure.
Solid.
It was just so well written. It was, truly a gift. I got to say that from the bottom of my heart, all the writing was incredible. And to me, how I got into it was...
Lost your video there for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're back.
How I got the role was very simple. The producers... Ask the casting person, we need someone like an Edward James Olmos type.
Okay. Ain't that some stuff?
And one of the producers said to the other producer, have you asked him? What? Have you asked him? He goes, oh, no, man. I mean, no, we didn't ask him. He turned down Star Trek. So, you know, he's not going to do this. I don't know, I think he does this. And so they said, well, just ask him. And so... I was working, I was doing a book festival in San Diego, the Latino Book and Family Festival, and that, I was there working and stuff, and something we created for the community, and been doing it for over 20 years. And all of a sudden, you know, my agents call me up and say, hey, man, they asked for you over at Universal. They want you to trial for this, not trial, but if you'd come in and talk to them about this television show that they have going, which is called Battlestar Galactica. And I said, wait a minute, is it a takeoff on the original? And they go, yeah. And I go, oh, wow. And I had never seen the original because in 1978, when the original came out, I was doing Zoot Suit every day. I was on stage every day and I didn't have any time to watch television. And so, but I said, well, you know, I really, and said, please read it. Just read it. And I said, oh, boy, boy. So, I read the first three pages, okay, which was a preface. It was almost like a treatment of how to read the script. The world that you were going to enter, had you not had read those first three pages, you would not have understood how this was going to be. Okay.
Right.
And I must say that it was brilliantly written. And those three pages sold me on reading the whole script. And when I read the whole script, I said, oh my goodness, this is really, really exceptional work.
Yeah,
and so I accepted the invitation to go meet with them, and I met with them, and I met with you know, the writers, the directors, the producers, mm-hmm. you know, everybody, and I will say that the only thing I asked of them is that they don't bring about in this world that we're going to create. That we keep it like Blade Runner was. Blade Runner, where there was no creatures from, you know, outer space.
Right. Okay.
There was, you know, I said, keep that integrity, you know, because I don't mind working with these
Cylons. Yeah.
Cylons. Okay. But don't put us on a world finding this world universe or this place in the universe that all of a sudden has these creatures, you know. Because the first creature I run into, I'm going to faint on camera, and you're going to have to write that he had a heart attack and died. It becomes a material.
That's amazing.
That was in the contract. That was in the contract.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. You're like hearing you talk now, Eddie. It's like. All these movies and shows that I've grown up with, you have had such a major part in at least crafting your story, but your character. But by crafting your character, you've helped craft a show and or movie around your character in many ways. You're not obviously the center of those movies or anything like that, but you add so much to the tapestry. It's amazing. It's really remarkable. Now going back and reviewing all these performances in my head, it's remarkable, Eddie. It really is. I'm going to ask you a few rapid fire questions. I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Discipline yourself to do the things you love to do when you don't feel like doing them. And remember that the more time you have in preparing, the better prepared you'll be.
I think that's a t-shirt. I think that's a, it's a good,
we'll tell Ron Moore, the creator of Battlestar Galactica, to use it.
That's a good t-shirt to have.
That's on the verge of being so ridiculous.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
All people are not what they say they are.
Interesting.
Yeah. It took me a long time for them to beat that out of me. I always thought that people were, you know, the way that they presented themselves.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you find yourself going, wow, man, what the heck happened? And you know, you're always giving, and I still to this day, I'm very, very much positive. And I give everybody the, you know,
benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, total benefit of the doubt. And that to me is the key. But that took me the longest to learn, wow, I can't really trust on first understandings and first time you meet someone. 99% of the time, 98% of the time you do hit it right on the head. I mean, basically, your friend is a friend, and they're nice to you. But it took me a while to really learn that there's always that side of people that can definitely come in. It really hurts. It hurts Not you so much, the person receiving it, but the person that is doing it. They're the ones who get really hurt because they're the ones who are doing it. I mean, you know, when somebody has a problem and they're giving me the problem, and if I don't take the problem, then the problem stays with them and they have to deal with it in the way they're going to deal with it, but it's their problem, it's not mine. And that's the hardest, I think, in life, period.
Okay.
That I've been finding.
Now, and three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, God. My favorite films. I love Lawrence of Arabia.
Uh-huh.
Let me give you three of my Kurosawa, uh-huh. David Lean. Mm-hmm. Okay, David Lean. And I would have to say Buñuel. Mm-hmm. Those are three directors of films that I really appreciate. And I get so much out of it, along with, you know, Fellini's.
Of course.
Phenomenal. I mean, it's phenomenal. And there's so many brilliant. And here, you know, there's some great, great directors that have been on the planet that make just exquisite films that, you know, I've liked a lot of the new films coming out of like Korea and.
Oh, yeah. A Parasite, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful stuff.
Excellent. And I love, I run the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival. That's what this is.
Yes, La Leaf. I've screened there, sir. My films have screened there. Yeah. Yes, over the years.
So, you know, we get to see films that most people don't get to see.
Right.
And I'm so grateful. Because doing this festival over the last 20 years, I've been so grateful in what I've been able to understand, view, that has helped me as an artist and as a creator and also as a human being to understand myself better. Because when you're only looking at certain types of films made in one area, mm-hmm. say the United States and the commerciality of the films that they make, once in a while you find artistic films that really do amount to a lot of great work.
And one last question, because I think it's really important. I would love to hear your opinion on this. You know, I'm a Latino filmmaker. I'm Cuban boy from Miami. And, you know, your films over the years, Stand and Deliver, American Me, those are some of the spotlights when I saw a Latino presented in a different light than the general, you know, way that Hollywood presented Latinos. What do you think now, because you've been fighting that good fight for a long time of trying to get, you know, more Latinos onto the screen and presented and see yourself as, you know, as on screen. And that's why I love In the Heights when it just came out, which is remarkable.
I loved it.
Oh my God. I was like, when they showed the flan, I almost cried. I mean, it was remarkable. So in your opinion, where you see things going now and there is more representation out there, how do you feel seeing this? Because you've been fighting that fight for decades now.
I love it. I mean, it's all that makes us all stronger and better. And not only the culture that's being represented, but the ability for other cultures to experience situations through the eyes of these other cultures. And it really makes a difference. It makes a big difference. And I got to tell you, the more we get to do that, the more we have diversity inside of our film world, which is, you know, I had a choice of continue to do theater or do film. And to do both, you can. But basically, it really takes a long time to do a film, and, you know, to develop. Because I produce them, I direct them, I act in them. I, you know, help write them, you know. Mm-hmm. And so each project takes, you know, anywhere between a year to 10 years, 15 years. American Me took 18 years and to make. And, you know, so I had to commit myself. If I was trying to do theater, I wouldn't be able to do that kind of work on film at all. And the choice was, okay, so where does the most impact come from with the time that I have? Because I'm already 75 years old. I've been doing this for 50 years, and it went by like that. Yeah. I got a lot of great, you know, work that I've been able to accomplish, but I would not have been able to accomplish as much in film had I done theater also. And so I really sacrificed being able to go on stage. But I did a lot of theater. I did, 18 years of theater.
But so. Eddie, I appreciate you, my friend. I appreciate all the work you've done over the course of your career and fighting the good fight and helping filmmakers and helping get stories on the screen that need to be told. And I appreciate you so much, my friend. So thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much for doing this. You're helping a lot of people.
I want to thank Eddie for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Eddie, thank you so much, not for only coming on the show, but for everything you've done throughout your career to give light where there has been darkness and hopefully change a few people's minds with your performances and your portrayals of your characters on screen. So thank you again so much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch Eddie's new film, Chasing Wonders, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/483. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review on the platform of your choice. It really helps the show out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.